Hello, Chatterbox listeners. It's Rob here with another Countryside Podcast highlight. We join Chris and Matthew beneath his famous row of washboweled oak trees, where they uncover the secrets of the worms below and the snails hibernating high above.
Well, it's a grey February day, but just hints of brightness and spring just a few weeks away.
I know. I'm so looking forward to it, although I like any of the seasons that we have, all four seasons. They're all quite distinct. But sometimes at this time of the year, winter seems to drag on and on and on forever. And I really enjoy it when you have that low sun. And for the last 2 weeks, maybe three, the east coast of England has been absolutely covered like this blanket. It's better than solid rain and heavy courtfuls of snow, perhaps, but it's gloomy, to say the least. So it just seems to carry on and on and on.
And we had our old friend the easterly wind the other day, and anyone who hasn't experienced a Norfolk easterly and a north easterly, then you really haven't lived.
No, you haven't lived. My father said, you're a sore oak boy if you stand sideways, go past you. Yes. Anyway, we're out on one of the hay fields here. We've got pollen and nectar field one side of us, and then overwinter wild bird seed mix. And we've just driven down a lovely row of oak trees, and these starred the sort of entrance of it was independent television, ITV, I think. It was a programme called Countrywide, and each week the programme scanned down the sort of introduction titles, scanned down this whole row of oak trees one by one, and there's about 20 here. They're all in a line. It was obviously an old hedge bank from years ago. The hedge is not there, but the trees stand there, and they're really unusual for oak trees. They've got what we call the wash boughs on them, which hang down and almost touch the ground. And every one of them, each and every one of them, has got ivy on them. And they're really lovely habitat. But there's a branch hanging up there. That's an interesting. I hadn't noticed that. It's probably snapped off in the 87 gales. That's been up there a long time. And it's hanging vertically down. So we will be going under that in a minute or two. I like to live dangerously. Right, but yes. We're carrying on that theme for this week's podcast of things you don't normally see.
And you've got rid of your five-pronged fork, and now you're armed with a different tool.
Yes, it's a spade. And so we're looking at more of those foundation species, if you like, because that's what supports everything else. And now this is another species that's come very popular. So I'm going to put the spade in the ground like that and dig some soil out, cut a nice square. Should be lovely and fertile here. And what we're looking for,
lovely sod there,
lovely soil, very, very fertile. And I'm just looking to see if we can find our local earthworms. So here we are.
We saw brandling earlier.
Yes, we saw brandling. This is a common earthworm, Lumbus terrestris. Sort of blunt at one end and sharp at the other end, and the sharp end is the head end. There it is, extended. So it's bigger than what you think, because it just got disturbed and it's come out of my hand, and it's virtually from one side of my hand to another. And
hello, rat.
Rat's arrived. He's come out. He's very excited about this. Another one here somewhere, just hidden up in the soil. So very, very high population of worms on this field, because it's been grass now for best part of 20 years. So you can see the soil structure full of roots, full of humus in the soil, and that's the food stuff of these worms. And so they do something really important. I think on an acre of ground, and this little bit that I'm kneeling on is about 10 acres, and worms bring up about 10 tonnes of soil per year, per acre. So
quite a lot, and it's fertile soil because it usually comes from deep down. So earthworms will digest all the organic matter in the soil. It passes through them from the sharp end to the blunt end, if you like, and comes out at the other end as a worm cast. So wherever we look on the ground, we can see lots of them. Look, this is the work of the earthworm. One there, one there, one there, one there. And at the bottom of all of those will be quite a large earthworm.
And they're constantly excavating and churning.
All the time. Apart from in the sort of worst time of the year for earthworms is the middle of summer. Perhaps the time that most people like best. And worms need moisture in the soil. Excuse me. So what they do is aestivate. They go right down into the soil. It's a kind of midsummer hibernation, if you like. So there we are. That's the common earthworm. A good acre of fertile soil, particularly grassland, and particularly more over in the centre and the west of the United Kingdom, where they get a higher rainfall over there. The ground is more difficult to cultivate quite often, so more pasture equals more worms, and in a good acre you can have 3 million earthworms. There's probably close to that on this particular field, although the first little sod of soil I dug out there, that's what you call it, I wasn't swearing, there was just two or three worms in that. If I went down a bit deeper, because the soil is quite cold at the moment, and the worms are gone down a little bit into the soil profile, but they'll bring up sort of soil with lots of minerals in it, and so they're hugely important, and again very fashionable. So farmers are being encouraged to do something called min-till, where you stop ploughing the soil for many of the crops that are grown. Things like cereals you can min-till, certainly peas and some of the legume species, but some you do need to deep cultivate for, things like sugar beet perhaps and potatoes, the root crops in particular, like deep friable loose soil to grow in, and so you have different requirements. So really important. So farmers are now cutting out ploughing for at least two of the three arable rotations that occur and replacing it by min-till, just cultivating the soil in a top 50 millimetres, perhaps that's 2 inches deep only, and then planting the seeds in there, and that's helping worms to aerate the soil because you get a higher worm population. You're not turning the soil, destroying their little structures that they have, and also the worms can then aerate the soil, and it also, funny enough, the opposite to what you think, it decreases flooding because you have a good aeration in the soil. But being English, we have funny habits in our country. There's a competition at Willemston in Cheshire, and it's run each year, and it's called a worm charming competition where a field is set aside and you have various contributors coming with all their different methods of charming worms. You're not allowed to use chemicals of any sorts. You can use tuning forks. Some people use whistles. And the record is set, of course, by a farmer's son. And you're given 3 square metres of turf. And you have to sit there. And you usually have somebody with you called a gillie to collect the worms as they come to the top.
You're making this up, Mike.
No, I'm not making this up. This is the honest truth. You can look it up. World Worm Charming Competition. And the record is a farmer's son. It wasn't me. But he scored 511 worms. That's the British record. And quite often people have a score of 200. But if, amusingly, on my lawn in the morning, sometimes gulls will wait and I put out any of the previous night's cooking. I'm called Alfred the Great sometimes because I sometimes burn tea and have to put it outside. The gulls wait there, but while they're waiting, they sometimes stand on the ground and splash their feet on the ground. It's like a little dance, and that brings the worms up to the top, and that's the sort of basis of the World Worm Charming Championship. I know, you couldn't make it. It can only happen in Britain.
Do you think we should enter a High Ash Farm team next year?
Yeah, I think so, yes. Yes, yeah. I'd have to worm my way out of that one, because I'd show everybody up, I think, yes.
Boom, boom.
Right, there we are. So we've only got a few steps to go for our next one. I've put the little sod of soil back down. I think I'll have that on my gravestone when I pass away. Under this sod lies another one.
Rat has run away from that joke.
Don't blame him. Right, let's have a look at one of these oak trees here, Matthew. Low branches. We've got to kind of duck down to get close into the trunk.
What did you call this when there's the branches
alone?
These are
called wash boughs. Wash boughs. So they're branches that come out low on any particular oak trunk. And, of course, out in the countryside, when you were ploughing with horses or later on with tractors, you wanted to get as close as possible to the hedgerow bottoms. So nearly always the wash boughs were cut off because they'd kind of wash past you or catch on the tack that the horses had or knock the exhaust pipe off the tractor. And funny enough, the little road on the other side there that runs down through the farm is called Wash Lane, but I think it's called A Wash Lane. I think there's an A missing from it. So let's just creep in underneath the canopy.
There we go. Lots of ivy. Good habitat for the birds and food as well. And we've gone right underneath here now.
Yes, and there's a bit of a giveaway here, because if you look on the ground, Matthew, lots and lots of snail shells.
That looks like they've been dinner for someone.
Yes, we have a very high population of long-tailed field mouse here, and it's a favourite food for them. I'm just going to pick one of the shells up, and you can see it's been nibbled halfway down the back, and the body of the shell is missing.
It's quite an effective bit of escargot eating.
Yes. So most of our snails hibernate under old tree roots, right down in the ground, particularly dead trees or trees that have fallen over. And it's another one of those things that you don't see. But snails just like to be kept cool and frost-free over the winter months. So they will climb up trees like this oak tree into the ivy. So if you just come round a little bit more, this is a bit of a shock for you.
Oh, wow.
10,000 snails.
There they all are, hugging.
On this tree. Look in here.
Hugging close to the trunk.
Can you see? Look. I'll keep coming all the way round, and it's nearly always on the north or the northeast side. I've had a go at counting them. They go up there 20 feet up the trunk. Just look, and what I'll do is I'll invite my poor neighbour, Laura Coven, to come down with her camera and take a picture from just where we're looking. If you look in there, they're not just snails against the trunk, they're snails on snails on top of snails.
Well, they're taking advantage of all this knotted stuff from the ivy, aren't they?
Yes, just look in there. Can you can see you can't pack any more in. And there's the minutest ones there, about the size of a match head, on either a parent, they've got a piggyback in, and ready for hibernation.
And the patterns on the shells,
yes,
as well.
If you just duck down a little bit more and come round some more, look, just look in here. It is just an amazing
thousands.
Sight. Yeah, so I've guesstimated 8,000-10,000 just on this tree. They are just packed. Look at the patterns, as you said. There's 10 snails there. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 8 on that one. And on one ivy leaf. Look.
Looks a bit precarious, but they're all hibernating.
They're hibernating. They seal themselves off with a kind of mucus seal. And that protects them. But what they don't like is the warmth So that's why they're on the northeast side of this particular tree, not on the southwest. So they'll miss the prevailing winds that generally come in at this time of the year. But the most important thing is not to have the sun on them, which kind of wakes them up. So it's a really lovely way to spend the winter when the weather's like this, hibernating. And of course, yeah, they've got a lot of history. And they migrate here from the fields beside us, because these fields were used to grow sugar beet. Sugar beet on this farm was difficult to grow because the soil was quite acidic. So each year, for, or I should suppose, 8-10 years, I had a product from the local sugar beet factory. It's got a very romantic name. It's called Cantley Waste Sludge. And it's magnesium limestone. Very, very good at neutralising soil acidity. The sugar beet loved it when I was a sugar beet grower. And consequently, the pH went up from about 5.5, which is pretty acidic. And my father had been using something to aggravate the soil acidity called sulfate of ammonia, which was an early nitrogen fertiliser, had lots of sulphur in it, and caused the soil to be a little bit acidic. So to neutralise all that he did and the crops that had been taken off for years and years and years, put lots of this Cantley waste sludge on and brought the pH up to about 8.5, which is very alkaline. If you're growing crops in your garden that need lime, then that's, you'd know what I mean. It's quite sort of very sweet soil, if you like. And so consequently, that's the ideal soil regime for snails, because their shells are made almost entirely of calcium. So in heathland, particularly down in southwest Norfolk, we have the Brecklands down there. The soil is acidic, it's heathland, and you don't get many snails at all because there's no calcium to make those important shells. So,
well, this is good snail country here, and yes, they're all asleep at the moment, yes, but a lot of those will be bird food as well.
Yes, as well, because they'll go right out in the middle of these fields. And in years gone by, when I used to do radio pieces, again, I hope no local farmers are watching what I was doing. I'd come at this time of the year and visit these hibernation sites with a bottle of my girlfriend's nail varnish, bright pink, and I'd put a spot of this pink nail varnish on a snail shell. So when I was walking out on the fields to check the crops, occasionally I'd come across a snail, and it'd be 200 metres out from the trees. They go quite a distance. Snail's pace, I suppose, has come into our language. And even worse today, with the modern postal service as well, we've got something called snail mail, which delineates out sort of how the mail sometimes takes a few days to deliver, but does make me smile. And years and years and years ago, it's one of the things my mum said. She'd send my two sisters out in early May to look for either a snail or a slug. And the reason was, she'd say, Pat, Susan, my sister's names, if you find a snail first, then you're in luck because you're going to find a man with a house, hence the snail's carrying his house on his back. And if you find a slug, well, he's going to be a little bit slow and probably not much use, and he certainly won't have a house with him. So look out for a snail first, and that'll be who you marry.